All right, we're ready for case number 5-08-4314, Larry Johnson versus Carl Seville, and we have Mr. Kenneth Flaxman.
Good morning. May it please the court. When this case was filed in the district court, there was a split of authority among district judges in the Northern District about what causes of action, if any, were available to someone who had been prosecuted and acquitted and claimed that the prosecution was the result of some sort of police misconduct. Some judges were of the view that there was no claim, that Newsom took away malicious prosecution. There was no federal claim. Newsom took away malicious prosecution, and that you could not complain about denial of a fair trial because you had received a fair trial and been acquitted. Other judges were of the view that if you could show that police officers had fabricated inculpatory evidence, or if police officers had withheld exculpatory evidence, then you can assert some kind of a due process claim. Some judges called it a Brady claim, but there were some district judges who were allowing that cause of action to proceed. Judge St. Eve, who signed to this case, is one of those judges who allowed the due process cause of action. Another case was another judge, Judge Holderman, who decided the Carajal case, which this court reversed while summary judgment was pending before the district court. That's the reason why, after the district judge granted summary judgment, we went to her with a motion to amend, saying we really would like to re-argue on appeal the Fourth Amendment question that was set out in the complaint. And that's what we're doing in this, seeking to do in this court, and there's vigorous arguments raised about waiver and things of that sort. I would like to answer questions about that, but if not, I'll move on to the second point, which is that there was a state malicious prosecution claim, which district court had jurisdiction of, was not time barred. District court said that you could not proceed on the malicious prosecution claim because the plaintiff did not show that there had not been probable cause to arrest. Probable cause to arrest is not an element of the malicious prosecution. It's about the prosecution. It's not about the police officer's split-second decision about whether somebody should be arrested or not. It's about the prosecutor's mature, deliberative determination that we should go ahead and prosecute this person because we have enough admissible evidence to find him or her guilty. And that's a different question than what the district court decided. And when you look at the probable cause to prosecute question and consider the evidence in the light most favorable to the plaintiff, where you have the police officer who is making up a story about an admission that the defendant did not make, where the police officer is misrepresenting to the grand jury and to the prosecutor what this these log sheets show that the girl from the prison was checked out to somebody else, wasn't checked out to the defendant. Then you have a jury question about whether there's probable cause for prosecution. And under Illinois law, that's enough for which the jury can infer malice and return a verdict for the plaintiff. So we should be allowed, irrespective of the waiver question. And I remember from one of Judge Evans' opinions the phrase flip-flop being used about waiver, and perhaps that will be used again. Irrespective of the waiver question, there's a state court malicious prosecution claim which should be allowed to proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Blackman. Mr. Burks.
Good morning. I'm Paul Burks, Assistant Attorney General. I represent Detective Seville in this case. maybe I'll start with the malicious prosecution claim. And this case was brought, as Mr. Flaxman mentioned, as a civil rights claim with a supplemental state law claim. And now on appeal, really, all that's left standing is that supplemental state law claim. The Brady claim is gone voluntarily. By the plaintiff has decided not to pursue it on appeal, although we pursued it in the district court, And the Fourth Amendment claim was never pursued in the district court, has sort of been, there's been an attempt to resurrect it in post-trial motion, which was denied, and now there's been an attempt to bring it on appeal, but it's never really been really identified exactly what the Fourth Amendment claim, what are the elements, what are the facts relevant to it, and I think this goes directly to our waiver argument, which is that if as plaintiff's counsel mentioned, there's some uncertainty in the district courts or some conflict in the district courts about what claims are permitted and what those elements are, that's the reason why these claims have to be kind of honed and identified in the district court first. I mean, the basic principles behind waiver, that you get a full evidentiary record, that you preserve judicial resources, you know, single bite at the apple, that you avoid surprise and prejudice to the other party, that you test issues in the adversarial process. All of those reasons, when you have something that's uncertain, that's sort of where the legal claim might be novel or need some development, all of those reasons that underlie the waiver doctrine, they really have more force in this circumstance. So there's really no reason to excuse waiver. This is really the kind of circumstance where this kind of claim has to be brought into district court, and it has to be identified and litigated before it's really ripe for an appellate decision to decide what the contours of this kind of a Fourth Amendment claim might be. And even as the Supreme Court said in the footnote that plaintiff's counsel relies on, they have never identified the contours of a Fourth Amendment Section 1983 claim in this context. As this court said, I think it was in Gauger versus Hendel, we've reserved the question of what the Fourth Amendment commands in this type of a case. And this, I think, is really not the case to pursue it or to try to hone those standards, because it was never raised in the district court, because the claim was waived, and that this court, if they're looking for a vehicle to clarify the law in that respect, this is really not a good one. Now, turning to the state malicious prosecution claim, this claim turns on whether the proceeding against plaintiff was supported by probable cause. And probable cause is enough evidence to convince a reasonable person of the plaintiff's guilt. In this case, there was a statement by the victim who testified at trial that the plaintiff was guilty of the crime of criminal sexual abuse, that she had sex with the plaintiff while she was 17 and incarcerated, and he was essentially a prison guard. There was in the investigative file the testimony of, or I'm sorry, the statements of her roommate and other inmates at the time who corroborated that at the time of the sexual encounter, she also told them about it. There was evidence in the investigative file that the plaintiff had had improper contact with other inmates, underage inmates, before and after they had left, that he had had sexual contact with other inmates as well. And there was some documentary evidence that corroborated the time, the date, and the place that the victim alleged the incident occurred, meaning that she was on cleaning detail. The date was the date that another inmate had been brought to the hospital because she OD'd. All of that was corroborated by the evidence in the file. So a reasonable person looking at that evidence, looking at that information, would I think that the plaintiff was guilty. And in fact, at the end of the trial, the judge who was the finder of facts, said this is a really close one. This really could have happened. It might have happened the way the prosecution says, but it's not quite beyond reasonable doubt, so I'm going to find not guilty. To me, that's a statement that when all the admissible evidence was said and done, there was a finding of reasonable cause to pursue or probable cause to pursue the prosecution, even if there was not a finding of beyond reasonable doubt. Now, this assertion, there is an assertion, at least in a reply brief, and I think raised an oral argument, that the prosecution has to go beyond maybe what a reasonable person would believe and go into what a reasonable person who understood the rules of evidence and understood what would be admissible and what wouldn't be admissible in court would believe. And so I think the argument is that the prosecution has to discount evidence that it doesn't think it can get admitted to court. But that's really not part of the probable cause analysis. The probable cause analysis is a reasonable person looking at all the evidence. And it wouldn't make sense for a prosecutor to try to predetermine all the evidentiary rulings, because evidence comes in for one reason, even if it's not admissible for another reason. It can come in, it can be admissible for a separate reason. So all of the information that the prosecutor knows may very well become admissible in court depending on how the trial comes, the trial goes. And so, it should all be considered in the probable cause inquiry, which is what the prosecutor did here.
You're not really relying on the trial judge's, comment.
No.
That's not finding, is it?
A little evidentiary richness is all, just to point out that if the question is, was the evidence in the investigative file admissible? The comment by the trial judge at the end of the day, where only the admissible evidence came in, shows that the evidence was fairly evenly balanced. But no, I don't think that's a critical point. I think if you look at the evidentiary file, if you look at what the prosecutor relied on when they pursued the claim, you'll find probable cause to pursue.
He might have just been throwing a bone to the assistant state's attorney so he doesn't get fired or something.
Fair enough. He very well might have been. Fair enough. If there are no questions, thank you.
Flaxman, anything further?
Point that I wanted to make about the judges often say things that aren't findings. Thank you.
Except Judge Tinder.
Right.
When he says something, it's always a finding.
Is Indianapolis bigger than Milwaukee?
Oh, several times.
According to it's the most affordable city right now, too, according to something in Forbes magazine or something like that. Not enough to make me want to move there. All right. Now we'll take this case under advisement and move to the final case.